All right, good evening. I'm not Jay Wilson, in case you're wondering, so. I was looking forward to hearing whatever he had to bring up, but we'll just keep moving on in Hebrews. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 9. All right, we're in Hebrews chapter 9, and then we're actually going to read verses 1 through 12. We'll read 1 through 12, and we'll go from there. We'll actually, remember, we're going to start talking with the Day of Atonement. Day of Atonement is kind of where we left off. That's what we're going to talk about today. So Hebrews chapter 9, verses 1 through 12. Now even the first covenant had regulations of divine service and the earthly sanctuary. For there's a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, in which were the lampstand, the table, and the sacred bread, which is called the holy place. Behind the second veil there was a tabernacle, which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense, and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, which was a golden jar holding the manna, and Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. Above it were cherubim of glory, overshadowing the mercy seat. But of these we cannot now speak in detail. Now when these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine service. But into the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place was not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered which cannot make the one who serves perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until a time of reformation. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. All right, perfect. So a couple things just to remind us. We were talking about the tabernacle. Remember where chapter 8 kind of was? What was kind of the thought process of chapter 8? Or what's really the theme of chapter 8? It was drawing way back in your memory bank. I know chapter 8 was a whole chapter ago, okay? That was a long time ago. But chapter 8, we talked about the covenants, right? The old and the new. The old and the new. And we ended chapter 8 kind of with this idea that the old is done. Not only is it obsolete, right? Obsolete meaning that there's no real value to it anymore, right? It's obsolete. Not only is it obsolete, but it's soon to disappear. It's obsolete. It's ready to disappear. That's where chapter 8 ended. And we kind of talked about the destruction of Jerusalem. Then we go into chapter 9, right? And going into chapter 9, he starts by mentioning things about the first covenant. And so he says, hey, yeah, the old covenant is obsolete and it's going to disappear soon, right? And this is obviously back in those times. The old covenant, you know, this is in that context, not nowadays. But he's saying that those things are obsolete. But he comes into chapter 9 and he says, even the first covenant, though, it had all of these different things. It had the tabernacle, it had the priests, and it had gifts and sacrifices. This is where we come into chapter 9. So he says, yes, the old was obsolete, it's about to disappear, but even the first covenant still had these things in place. And this will kind of help set us up for the rest of the context of chapter 9. Now, something I haven't mentioned, which I debated how far I'm not going to spend a lot of time. We're going to just briefly touch on it, since you're probably wondering that I kept reading verse 1 of chapter 9, 6, and 9. I kept saying serve or service. It's actually the noun for latria, which is service. It's not to serve, it's not a verb, but it's service. It's a noun. So just so you're aware of why I keep saying even the first covenant had regulations of divine service. Now, New King James Version, I think they get this right. The New King James, if you read through the New King James, you're not going to get confused on what's worship and what's service. They just shoot straight. They just say, this word means this. And so they use service time and time again. Now, again, many people have come up. They preach messages in classes and done excellent jobs. I'm not going to just spend another time preaching on this. But it is important in the context to understand the difference. And so we'll just briefly touch on this. Was it the priest or the people that were the ones who were performing the service? It was the priest. So this is hopefully going to help us a little bit. That's almost as far as I want to go. He keeps talking about service, service, service. So who are the people who are the ones who are really going to be implied here as doing these services? This is going to be priestly talk. This is priest, okay? This is not the people. And so sometimes we might get a little mixed up on those things. I think that is probably sufficient for a little bit of review on that. I just want to touch on that. And then I did mention in verse 5, we talked about the cherubim overshadowing the Ark of the Covenant, right? I had this beautiful picture on the board last week. It was stunning, right? Now, I'm going to start drawing these pictures of the tabernacle, and I'm going to start selling them and make lots and lots of money. And no, they're really hard to follow, unfortunately. I'm sorry. I don't have these big, beautiful pictures to show you guys. But the mercy seat was something that we mentioned as well. Now, remember, God, he is a God who did destroy, he consumed Nadab and Abihu, right? When they offered strange fire before the Lord in Leviticus 10. He destroyed them, right? And that's kind of where we were looking. We kind of briefly talked about that last week. That sounds pretty harsh, right? You know, sometimes I'm in the school and the school kids are saying, wow, Mr. Serrano, why did you just, you know, bring down the law on me? Why did you not, give me grace on this or whatever it might be? And sometimes I do, but, you know, I also want to teach them that you don't always get off easy. There's not always grace. And to be honest, that's kind of how life goes, right? So God, he had a very specific way in which he wanted things. And if you were to go outside of that, in many cases we've seen, you died, right? Now, he still had a method, or he still had a system by which people could come to him, though. He still had a system by which they could approach him. There could still be propitiation. There could still be atonement. So the word there for mercy seat, and I didn't mention this last time, but it does have the communication of propitiation. That means that God is pleased. There's propitiation there. So Romans 3:25, let's just turn over there real quick and take a look at this. This is also where this word is used. Romans chapter 3, let's actually start in verse 21. Romans 3:21. But now apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe, for there is no distinction. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, being justified as a gift by his grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood through faith. This was to demonstrate his righteousness, because in the forbearance of God, he passed over the sins previously committed. He goes on and he talks about he was just and the justifier of those who would believe in Jesus Christ. That word there, though, for propitiation is the same word that we see in Hebrews 9 where it says mercy seat. What did the high priest, what did he come to God to find on the Day of Atonement? They found propitiation, right? And this is kind of cool, because if anybody just decided they're going to just walk up to the King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and they're going to go before God in their sin, what's going to happen to them? They're going to die, right? Remember, we're going to read this in a second, but Leviticus 16, Moses was very specific. He said to Aaron, he's like, Aaron, if you go and you go to God in the wrong way in the presence of God, guess what's going to happen to you? You're going to be like your two sons, and you're going to get killed. You're going to die. So this is kind of intimidating, maybe. But also, at the same point, on the Day of Atonement, what does the high priest go before and find with God? He finds favor, right? There's the Day of Atonement. There's an atoning, not just on behalf of the priests, but also on behalf of Israel collectively as the people. This would be extremely important. And we'll kind of talk about that a little bit more. So the mercy seat of God, I got that kind of squared away on there too. So let's go back to Hebrews chapter 9. Any comments or anything you guys would like to throw in at this point? I'll give you mine.
Did you cover why he uses the tabernacle as an example as opposed to the temple?
I think we did a little bit. Not super in depth, but yeah. No, do you have any comments on that you would like to make quick?
I just think it relates to the fact that he's been talking about Moses and Aaron and all the original first covenant things. And the temple that stood before them never had the glory of God in it. So, anyway.
Yeah, this is the pure form of which we get from the actual Exodus case. This is the thing that he's been building the whole time. And same with the temple, there's a lot of interesting things. Obviously, the presence of God had never been there. And then also, the tabernacle was that pure form how God initially established the first covenant. So, yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Okay. We do have a lot of reading today. I'm going to go through the whole, I'm not sure exactly if I'm going to go through all of Leviticus 16, but we are going to go to Leviticus 16 in a second. So let's read Hebrews 9, verse 6 and 7. Now when these things have been so prepared, remember the tabernacle, all the things we had talked about a couple weeks ago. When these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine service. But into the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. So, how often were the priests entering into, remember the outer tabernacle is that holy place, that first place. How often were the priests entering into that outer tabernacle? Every single day, right? They were entering there every single day. They would go in and then they would, in the morning and at twilight, they would burn on the altar of incense. And then they would also, remember on the Sabbath, we discussed that recently as well. They would go in, and then the Sabbath they were more busy than usual, but on the Sabbath they would eat some of that bread, the loaves, the bread, the presents, and then they would also bring in new loaves as well. They did lots of things on the Sabbath. But every other day, they were going in continually into the outer tabernacle. Did they ever go into the Holy of Holies, which is called the inner tabernacle here? No, other than the high priest that one time of a year. So let's go to Leviticus chapter 16. Yeah, I'm looking at how many verses are in this chapter. Maybe not the whole thing. All right, Leviticus 16, let's start in verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they had approached the presence of the Lord and died. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell your brother Aaron that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat which is on the ark, or he will die, for I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat." We're going to talk about that today. Aaron shall enter the holy place with this, with a bull for a sin offering and a ram for burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen tunic, and the linen undergarments shall be next to his body, and it shall be girded with linen sash, attired with a linen turban. These are the holy garments. He shall bathe his body in water and put them on. He shall take from the congregation of the sons of Israel 2 male goats for a sin offering and 1 ram for a burnt offering. Then Aaron shall offer the bull for the sin offering, which is for himself, that is, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household. He shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the goat, one lot for the Lord, and the other lot for the scapegoat. Then Aaron shall offer the goat on which the lot for the Lord fell and make it a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot for the scapegoat fell shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it and to send it into the wilderness as a scapegoat. So, let's kind of just walk through this Day of Atonement. This was in the seventh month, the tenth day. It only happened once a year, even on leap years. And the way this all would work is that, remember, I kind of briefly talked about this all last week. The high priest generally was wearing a very colorful coat. He was wearing different, he even had stones on him. He had a breastplate. He had a big hat on him as well. He had a very fancy attire most of the time. And maybe you've looked it up. You've seen the pictures. But what was different about the Day of Atonement? What was the high priest wearing on the Day of Atonement? And I think I mentioned it last week. His garments were a specific color. They're all white, right? One of the big things that we mentioned last week is that repentance was really to be on the mind. They even mention it later. This was a day that nobody was supposed to be working. It was a holy day. It was a day of rest. Nobody should be working. So the people were repentant. I've seen some stuff that the people probably were fasting as well. The idea is that the people were approaching God, and it wouldn't just be. It wasn't just, maybe we can kind of get into this modern way of thinking where, the one guy, maybe the preacher, he's going to take care of everything, let him handle it all, and, we're going to go about our daily, day-to-day business, he'll take care of everything. The priest, the high priest, yeah, he's going to do the Day of Atonement thing, but nobody's really that worried about it, right? Nobody's playing their part. No, that's not the general feel of how the people were. The idea is that the people were to be reverent and sincere in the way that they approached this day as well. Because if the people had the wrong mindset and heart towards this, guess what? They would fall out of good standing with God, really. And so the people, this is a day for everybody. This is not just a day just for the high priest and the priests kind of do their thing. The people would come, they would congregate, and they would be observing the things that were taking place. They'd be observing the sacrifice. They would be invested. They would be interested. This would be a very important day. Now, in America, we don't have any day that even comes close to the significance of this. There's not any day that I personally can think of that's, your birthday, Christmas is a big deal, right? Next week we're going to have Christmas, and maybe 4th of July, right? 4th of July is a big occasion, but it's nothing like the Day of Atonement. This would be extremely important in the minds of the Jewish people. Now, remember, the high priest is going into the presence of God. I'm going to draw a little sketch here, so we'll see how this looks. Hopefully I don't mess it up too bad, but I'm already messing stuff up. Okay. All right. This is a cube, or kind of, right? Actually, the Holy of Holies, the back room, was a perfect cube. It was about 15 feet by 15 feet by 15 feet high. So just think of a 15 by 15 room. I don't even know exactly. That might be like across the span of this stage or so. I don't know. What do you think, Dad? Is this about 15 feet? The construction guy? But yeah, there's this room back there. It's a perfect cube as well. This is where the ark would be. Okay? Remember we had the cherubim. Now, was there anything else generally back in the Holy of Holies? Or is it just this? Okay, yeah, I guess I'm saying other than the Day of Atonement. Generally, there's nothing else. It's just this guy back there. Can you imagine how intimidating that might be? Try to place your mind in that position. There's this, and it would be probably pretty dark too. It'd be dark. There is this back room, though, where God resides. And back there is this, you know, this this ark with the mercy seat that's overlaid with gold. And you kind of imagine putting your mind there, right? Now, on the Day of Atonement, there's something that we're going to see. God says that he shall appear in what? We briefly mentioned it at the beginning of Leviticus 16. What is God going to appear in? Yes, this is beautiful. I know it's hard. Maybe it's just confusing you more than anything. There's a cloud there, okay? There's a cloud. God is going to appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. Now, it's just so happens, actually, that we've been talking about the tabernacle and all of this in my Sunday school as well. But I was trying to make the kids think a little bit about this. Think about what that would be like to go back there and to just see this ark, this gold-plated ark, and then to see the cloud of incense essentially covering it, and to know that you are coming into the presence of God. Now, Hebrews makes the point. He says that there is something that needs to be brought into this. You couldn't just go back there, right? What were they to bring? He was not to go in without taking what? What could he not go in without? There's one item that he really needed. Without taking, I heard somebody say it, right? Blood, right? He needed blood. He could not go in without blood. Now, if the high priest goes in without blood, what is the significance of that? Obviously, he's going to die. We got that far, right? But why is he going to die if he goes in without blood?
Sin.
Yes, right? Because, okay, you're going into the presence of God, right? If you're sinful, if your sin is still on you, you're going to die, right? Can you go into the presence of God and just have all your sin on you? You're going to die, right? And so the Christian can't go into the presence of God, right, without having their sin atoned for. The high priest couldn't go into the presence of God, because if he did go into the presence of God and didn't have his sin atoned for, he's going to die, right? So he couldn't go. Hebrews says he didn't go in without taking blood. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But remember, he enters in how many times into, and I mentioned this last week, how many times does the high priest enter into the Holy of Holies? Kendall?
Twice.
Perfect. Yeah, he goes in twice, right? Now remember, what is he bringing the first time? It is blood. If you said blood, you're right. Okay, well, the blood of a specific animal, though. The bull's blood, right? And the bull's blood, this was, it says, for a sin offering. This would be for whose sin? This would be for the priest's sin, right? So the first things first, you're kind of envisioning this back room. The priest, he has to first, actually what he does before he does this whole process is he does wash his hands, right? He's washing, right? There's a picture of washing. He does wash, and then he puts on the garments. So yes, those who advocate always washing your hands, there's some biblical precedent for that. But he washes first. So you guys can kind of put together the communication of washing. God wanted his priest to be washed. He wanted him to be clean. He wanted him to come all in white, right? You're starting to see this picture. And he goes back there, and he brings first the blood of a bull. Now, there's something that we haven't really touched on. Let's go to verse 11, Leviticus 16, verse 11. Then Aaron shall offer the bull of sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his household. And he shall slaughter the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself. It's probably a good idea that our high priest going on all of our behalf has his sin taken care of, right? That's what the Israelite is probably thinking. Verse 12, he shall take a fire pan full of coals of fire from upon the altar before the Lord and two handfuls of finely ground sweet incense and bring it inside the veil. He shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the ark of the testimony. Otherwise, he will die. Now, as you can see on the picture, the Ark of the Covenant is back here. Let me get this dotted line out here. This might help. The Ark of the Covenant is back there. But remember, God said he's going to appear in the cloud. Now, how does the cloud get there? It's the incense, right? There is the incense back there. Okay. Now, I also, when I was working through this with the kids, I was thinking about, you know, Mr. Toole's office back there. Thinking about this little kind of darker room, you know, where there's just lamps that are lighting it up. And think about the ark. And then think about the significance of when the high priest would bring back incense on his first go-around. He would bring this incense back there. And then the cloud would just cover. Can you imagine what that would kind of look like? Maybe even feel like, right? So, There, one thing that has been really clear to me as I've been going throughout the Old Testament and studying things throughout Hebrews is that there is a time and place for the physical things. I mean, imagine being back in that room. It is the day of days, and the cloud, the smoke and the incense is just covering everything. Have you ever been in a smoke-filled, kind of a foggy type ambiance before? Yeah. I'm getting to there, probably. Well, almost. Imagine what that would be like. Now, there's a lot of things that would be doing for the high priest, but think about what that communicates in his mind. And he understands, Moses told Aaron, he said, the Lord will appear in the cloud on the mercy seat. Just picture that. Imagine what that would be like. What would he be feeling? I would be afraid of tipping the blood over, right? I'd be afraid of messing up, right? Now, obviously, you can't operate in fear, but there would be a lot of that nervous anticipation, that excitement that we talked about last week. And then on top of that, you have this cloud now. And you know that God is there. That would be pretty exciting, right? This would be a pretty exciting experience. Now, the physical things did represent spiritual things, and they did actually help as much as they could a physical-minded person to appraise or value spiritual things as much as they could, right? You know, hopefully these physical things were opening their eyes to the spiritual. But here's kind of the issue, right? When you think about a smoke that's just ascending or descending on a stage, what kind of comes to your mind when you think of that? I thought of like a mega church, right? And this is where you might see where people, like, they want to get that same feeling, right? Oh, you go to this kind of low-lit place, and the music is just right. And then the fog comes out onto the stage. You can feel the presence of God there, right? Oh, can you feel the presence of God? You know, that's kind of where those people are coming from, right? But if you actually think about it, this was kind of like that, except they actually knew that the presence of God was there, because if you messed up, you're going to die. It was a totally different setting. But you can kind of see why people want to adopt this as well nowadays. Now, I've intentionally been pushing this off for a couple weeks, but the incense is filling, the smoke is filling the room, the cloud, right? Remember in Hebrews chapter 9?
It mentions the outer tabernacle, right? So we could extend this out. You know, here's the rest of it, the room. Here's the doorway or the entry. And the table of bread, lampstand. And then what is right in front of the veil normally? The altar of incense, right? That's right here. Now, I've been able to kind of explain a couple of other things, not all of them, but the altar of incense would be right in front of the veil normally, and the altar of incense would be around 3 feet high, so it'd be like a standard cabinet height, roughly. So you have a shorter altar of incense. So typically when you look at that, like that little diagram I gave you guys a couple weeks ago, this would be right in the outer tabernacle, we could call it, from the context of Hebrews, typically. But remember Hebrews, where does he place the altar of incense? He says, in the Holy of Holies, right? He places this into here. He places it into the back room. Now, on the Day of Atonement, we just saw this would actually fit, wouldn't it? What was the Lord appearing in? The cloud. The cloud that came from what? The incense, right? He's bringing this back into this room. I'm going to discuss two major thoughts on this so you guys can at least have a grip, a handle on some things. Typically, it's right there. Now, what is, and we've already kind of gone, hopefully it's not too redundant, but the altar of incense is really communicating what for the Christian? What is like the new covenant anti-type? Prayer, right? So prayer, Luke 1, 10, there's different things you can associate. This was really, to even back then, but also now, it's to signify prayer. Now, if you go to Revelation 8 and 9, you'll see different things. There's a lot of crossover with this as well. The altar of incense, this incense rises up to God like prayer, right? Now, of all these different items, this is the one that is closest to the Holy of Holies. What does that communicate to you? The altar of incense is right, even normally, right up against the veil, which is right backed up to the Holy of Holies. Imagine going in as a priest every single day. You're going into this outer tabernacle first, and you get to go to the altar of incense, but you have the veil right there. Like, you know, you could reach your arm into the Holy of Holies if you wanted to, not that you would. Imagine what that would communicate, though, time and time again. Your prayers are right up next to the presence of God, even on a day-to-day basis, back in that system, right? We understand New Covenant, veil is torn, you know, etc. But even under the old terms, okay, and he specifies in chapter 9, he says, even the first covenant, the regulations were that the altar of incense was in the Holy of Holies. Right? And there's little horns on it, but looks like that. It is behind the veil. It is behind the veil. That would be the cloud, and the high priest goes back there. Now, I'm only bringing this up because it does come up actually quite a bit. As I've done my research over the past few weeks, I've realized just how much it comes up. There are questions that arise about whether it was actually the whole altar of incense or it was just a censer that goes into the back Holy of Holies. Okay, and I'll give you two main arguments, that basically the two discussions that kind of arise because of that. So in Leviticus 16, it does say fire pan. It could be used as a censer. Leviticus 16 is not specific. Okay, it does mention censer. Now, but I want to clarify, it's not specific. So he's not nullifying, he's not clarifying. He's just saying the incense, where the incense would be burned, or he's just saying that a fire pan, a censer, would be in the back. Okay. But if you look in, keep your place in Leviticus 16. We're going to go back to Hebrews chapter 9. In Hebrews chapter 9, verse 3, we'll read verses 3 and 4. Behind the second veil, right, that's that back portion. Behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies, having a, golden altar of incense. And the Ark of the Covenant, covered on all sides with gold. And he explains what's in the Ark of the Covenant. He places both of these back in the back room. Now, remember, I'll kind of give you my thoughts on this once we kind of wrap up. But the writer of Hebrews has given us other insights into other things that we didn't just find in the Old Testament, hasn't he? Think about Melchizedek, right? He goes on and he says, you know, lots of things about Melchizedek. Where did you find that in Genesis? I didn't find a lot of stuff that he was mentioning about Melchizedek in Genesis, but it was understood, and he's just saying, he basically is just clarifying things for us. There's nowhere in the Old Testament that you can clearly point to and say, oh, this is very clearly the altar of incense is in the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. Okay? It's not just like black and white. It's not extremely clear. But the writer of Hebrews, he seems to illuminate this altogether. He seems to be making this clear. It was actually the altar itself that went into the back room. Now, how many of y'all have ever had this discussion before or heard anything about the altar of incense being in the back room before? Probably not too many, you know, maybe a few. What do most people say was in the back room? On the Day of Atonement, sorry, yes. And not the altar itself, but it was just a censer, right? Just a censer. And this is a little ball that was set back there, right? And I'll kind of give you some reasonings why most people argue for that. We might say, well, in Hebrews chapter 9, it says the altar of incense. So what's the confusion? He just says the altar of incense. There's a few different things that people could throw out there. I'm not going to explore them all. Some people just say it was just the closeness of the prayer and the altar to God, right? Some people might argue that. That's why he put it there in Hebrews chapter 9. It was just because God, he desired to have prayers close, okay? That's a quick one. But the other thing is that the word for the altar of incense in Hebrews 9 verse 4 is actually, it's this word that could potentially mean incense, okay? And that's where people really get confused. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. Thumiatiron. Yeah. There you go. It's perfect. That word, lots of people will say it could be translated either way. You could argue that, okay? But here's kind of the issue. If that is not the altar of incense in verse 4, then where is the altar of incense elsewhere in the passage? There wouldn't be it. He doesn't mention it anywhere else, and so he just mentions a censer that is placed in the back room. Right? He doesn't mention this altar. Some people propose, I didn't really draw a picture, and I don't really have a ton of time to do this, but the altar was kind of designed like that, roughly 3 feet high. Some people will propose that the censer on top, the way it was kind of designed was, it's just this stand, and then there is a censer on top, okay? Which it's not terrible, but the thing is, it's called an altar. And if you look at even the altar on the outside of the tabernacle, an altar is not just necessarily a stand. Well, I guess it could be, but there's a lot of pictures you can actually find online where the altar of incense kind of has this grill set up on it. Almost as if you're burning within this thing. That's hopefully that. For those online, I apologize. But you can look up pictures. It has more of this permanence aspect to it, if you will. Now, the writer of Hebrews, in my mind, kind of settles it. He clarifies something that if you had any questions on in the Old Testament, it was clarified. What seems to be is that when the high priest would first go back and he has the blood of the bull, that he was moving the veil either around the altar of incense or he was just moving the altar of incense, you know, just that little bit into the action, within the veil. And then that would fill the room. But if you've ever wondered why Hebrews chapter 9, he mentions the altar of incense on the inside, that's the reason why. Because there was supposed to be a cloud that would develop within this room. And then the person, the high priest, would understand that God was there. Also, what do they communicate? The prayers. Jesus is our high priest, amen. And he goes into where? The Holy of Holies, right? And what does he take as well? I mean, our prayers are brought directly to God. He's going to mention this even more within Hebrews chapter 9. Sorry, Larry, we're actually out of time. We didn't even get close to getting through Leviticus 16. Yes. You got a quick question? Sorry.
Well, I don't know if it would be a quick question.
Oh.
So, are you saying that when it was initially created, that altar of incense was outside, and later on it got moved inside, or was it always inside? You're saying that's where the smoke came from.
So, the altar of incense, I guess I'll clarify that. Every other day, other than the Day of Atonement, would be on the outside of the veil. Okay. And then on the Day of Atonement, he would place it within the veil.
It was always that way from the moment they put the tabernacle together till we get here. Right?
Correct. Yes. As far as like the practice, yes. Yep. Perfect. And then that would fill the room. So yeah. Yep. So yeah. Sweet. I guess we'll call it there.